You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Like Junior before them, the suits of Vivendi did not quite seem to understand what they were purchasing. They had acquired telephone companies, tech investments, and media and publishing properties, funding those purchases by borrowing heavily. As so often with deals of this kind, the investment bankers who sold the bonds assured the public that these investments were sound. But servicing this debt required a reliable stream of incoming cash, and once the contracts were signed, Vivendi began pushing Morris for estimates of future earnings. These he declined to provide. Explained to his new bosses that his sales were subject to shifting whims of culture that he found impossible to understand and that he was powerless to control. If perhaps he was overconfident in his technology investments, then by contrast a lifetime of scouting the order taker had taught him that there was no such thing as a sure thing. The idea that some big-shot corporate tastemakers dictated their aesthetics to the masses was absurd, and Morris's entire career was predicated on the belief that the opposite was true. From the music explosion onward, he had always paid close attention to what the people wanted, and he tried his best to give it to them, even when it meant overruling his own critical judgment. Morris was agnostic about his own taste, even his own abilities. How was one 63-year-old white guy in a corporate office in Manhattan going to know what the kids wanted?
Stephen Witt is a graduate of the Columbia University School of Journalism. He's worked for hedge funds and in economic development in East Africa. His new book is How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
This book began with a personal journey for you, a journey deep into the heart of your own music collection, didn't it?
Deep into the heart of my own hard drive, in fact. So I had arrived at college in 1997 with a big beige box computer. This thing had about 2 gigabytes of hard drive space, making it about 1/16th the size of a current smartphone. By the end of the first semester, I'd pirated enough songs to fill that entire hard drive up. And by the time I graduated, I had about 1,000 albums. By 2007 or 2008, I'd become a compulsive hoarder of digital music and had over 100,000 MP3s. And looking over this enormous collection of music that I'd stolen, I sort of asked myself, well, how did it all get here anyway? And that became the impetus for writing this book.
It's such an interesting question because so many of us have acquired so much music. And I wanted to explore with you, why were you downloading albums by artists that you didn't like and weren't going to listen to?
Because I could. I think. It's a good question. I think everything that I downloaded, maybe in the back of my mind, I never downloaded anything I wasn't at least sort of interested in. Mm-hmm. So everything I downloaded, I think, well, I'd like to hear that someday. Later, people would start to offer bundled torrents of entire discographies of albums. So it was just easy to pick up. Let's say I like Neil Young, which I do, who I love. So I pick up literally everything Neil Young's ever put out, including many things that had never been officially digitized, but which the pirates had ripped from vinyl. And so then I have all of that. Now, am I going to listen to Neil Young's Landing on Water more than once in my life? No, but somehow I felt compelled to own it.
It's ironic that you bring up Neil Young, who fought so hard to preserve
yes.
her standards
and,
of musical.
And continues to fight a losing battle. The question of whether you can tell the difference between a high quality and an MP3 and a compact disc has generated an enormous amount of antagonistic discussion. People get really, really angry about this. On one side, you have sort of the inventors of psychoacoustic compression algorithms who say, no, we've done those double-blind scientific studies. You can't tell the difference. On the other, you have studio engineers and musicians like Neil Young who say, it's so obvious, I can easily tell. The public has never sided with Neil Young on this. The marketplace clearly shows people do not care about high fidelity. Pono is a dud. But they keep fighting. I should say Neil Young has spent much of his career standing next to, very large speakers wailing on a guitar. So I'm not sure that his hearing is terrific.
You know,
but I still love him.
Just this morning, I read that CD ripping is now illegal in the UK again. I guess it had been made legal last year for people who owned a CD to make MP3s from that CD. It's now been found illegal again. The ruling says the government can't make exceptions to copyright law without compensating rights holders for the harms from the charges. And because the UK government didn't demonstrate that ripping CDs doesn't cause harm to the rights holders, and because it didn't impose a levy to compensate for those harms, the legislation of ripping is now invalid.
Well, I mean, that's fine, but I don't think it's going to change anything. I mean, it was illegal the entire time that it was happening in the 90s and 2000s, too, and that didn't stop this enormous wave of piracy. I think the reality of the situation is, I should say, you know, contemporary copyright law goes back to a very similar problem in the United Kingdom in the 1700s, where people were sort of taking printing presses and ripping off other people's books. And the authors got so mad that they demanded the institution of what we now know as sort of copyright law.
Charles Dickens was a...
Charles Dickens later on, what Charles happened is he had actually like knockoff imitators. So he was Boz, B-O-Z, and then there was a guy named Boz, B-O-S, who, you know, I think Dickens' work was the Pickwick Papers, and then Boss came out with the Papers of Pickwick or something like this. So he essentially had, they weren't exactly plagiarizing him precisely, but they were just sort of ripping him off really bad. And so he sort of managed to get copyright law made stronger and enforced more strictly. But actually, the problems with this go back all the way to the 1700s, 1600s. And then trademark infringement goes back even further. But getting back to your point, the law has always frowned on this, meaning digital transfer of, you know, copyrighted material. When we do that, at least in theory, so there's third-party rights holders. So if you and I are exchanging music, you know, even off a flash drive, you know, it's so easy to do. But at least in theory, some third-party rights holder is supposed to get paid when we do this. In practice, it's very hard to enforce that. So in some ways, it doesn't matter that much what the law is.
It doesn't. This book that you've created is just a wonderful story, and I think it demonstrates the power and import of story itself. You give us three groups of characters who are really seem disparate and wildly separated, yet you manage to draw them all together and show how between the three of them they manage to help transform the world as we know it, especially of music.
Yeah, I mean, probably the most amazing thing that I came across is when looking at that library of music I'd stolen, I could trace a lot of it back to just three people.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did you do that?
Well, one of them, first I began with sort of the technical side, and that goes back to a guy named Karl-Heinz Brandenburg. Brandenburg was a German audio engineer working in a technology incubator who had this insight that essentially the human ear is full of inherent flaws that we've sort of have been passed down to us by natural selection. And the compact disc wasn't taking advantage of any of those flaws. So his MP3 encoder deleted information from the compact disc that allowing them to reduce the size of the files by exploiting these inherent flaws in the human ear. He completely failed to monetize this invention for a long time. He was completely locked out of the marketplace. He was a great inventor, but for a long time, not a very good businessman. Finally, in 1995, in desperation, he posted this MP3 encoder online on the what was then the sort of nascent World Wide Web. The pirates got a hold of it, and soon enough, it was, you know, everyone's hard drive had these MP3s on it. Eventually, he made hundreds of millions of dollars in licensing fees. But the irony is that was only possible through the greatest wave of copyright infringement that the world has ever seen.
And he himself was a man who had great need of copyright to protect his own work. And without the world of copyright, he probably would never have embarked upon the invention of the MP3 in the first place.
That's exactly right. He needed third-party rights holders to – he was a third-party rights holder, and he needed other people to respect his patent licensing ability. Fortunately for him, he ended up making money not from business to consumer, but business to business transactions. So essentially, he was licensing the right to have an MP3 player to Apple and Microsoft, and they sort of have to pay. They can't be caught infringing on copyright or patent protections because they're huge targets for lawsuits in a way that, like, you know, some kid in his dorm room is not. So he played it quite well in the end, I would say. And he became very wealthy.
But the road to that wealth was lined with some wild escapades. I mean, you talk about these guys discussing making an MP3 player and then whether or not they can copyright the thing.
Right. Well, they were not great businessmen. So if you went to their trade show in 1995 in Paris, Audio Engineering Society trade show, you would have seen essentially the future of music distribution. They had the MP3 encoder on a PC that could rip files from a compact disc. They had the MP3 decoder, which could play it back on a PC, so very similar to what ended up being like Winamp or iTunes. And third, and most importantly, they'd invented a handheld portable MP3 player device, which was basically a flash hard drive with a plug in it. And they sort of asked themselves, and then an MP3 decoding chip dedicated, and they asked themselves, should we patent this thing, this handheld MP3 player? And they sort of talked about it, and they're like, well, no, it's really just a hard drive with a plug in it. And so they didn't. And that decision left hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on the table.
It's such a fascinating story. And one of the things I think I have to say is that as you tell this story about all these characters, we have Doug Morris, who's ruling the music industry, and we have a couple of minor players, Dockery and Glover, who mm-hmm. At least seem minor, but were the centers of a huge shockwave.
Right.
You have a great sense of prose and honesty. There's a point in the book where you're talking about the Time Warner purchase of AOL, mm-hmm. which to many of us, when it happened, were just going, what is that about? And you have the sentence that he says, it was the stupidest transaction in the history of capitalism. And I think that sentence really gets to the sense of humor and honesty that you bring to this book.
I mean, it's important when you run the risk when you're writing about sort of technical subjects and business mm-hmm. subjects to get caught too much up in the sort of boilerplate legalese of that the corporations speak or the impenetrable jargon that the engineers speak. And you have to remember that, you know, the people reading this are human beings. They're not, they want to be entertained to some extent. So, but I also stand by that statement.
everybody will.
Time Warner's purchase of AOL was one of the stupidest, if I think the stupidest in terms of money lost, in terms of what they got for what they paid for. The worst transaction in the history of capitalism. It's hard to think of anything worse for me. So it really sunk them, and they ended up writing off something like $50 billion, I think ultimately closer maybe even to 100, essentially. And what that write-off means is it's just the accountants admitting that they overpaid by that much. So $50 billion, that's what they overpaid for what was essentially already a declining internet service provider that most of people using it were connected through via dial-up modem.
Now, one of the other players in your story, who you do a great job of, in turn, a guy I would not think of as being a sympathetic character, but you turn him into a very sympathetic character, is Doug Morris.
Yes. So as we said before, there's three people. This is guy number two. Morris was a powerful label executive for a long time. He came up in the record industry in the 70s as the protege of another label guy called Ahmet Erdogan, who's very famous. He signed Ray Charles. He signed Led Zeppelin. He assembled the Crosby, Stills, and Nash supergroup. So this guy had like just a tremendous reputation. He was a music industry legend. And Morris was his protege. When Erdogan stepped down in the 90s, Morris took over his Atlantic label, and then he transformed it away from classic rock dinosaurs and into hard-edged gangster rap. By 94, he was the most powerful music executive in North America based on these investments. But there was this, you know, massive outcry from the self-appointed guardians of our culture, people like Bill Bennett and Tipper Gore. And
you have a great description of Ben too. I can't. It's not radio friendly.
It's not radio. It's not radio friendly. Bennett is not my favorite person.
It's absolutely accurate, and he still maintains that.
He still maintains that level that of character, special charm that he has. Bob Dole too piled on, who I actually like, Bob Dole, but he piled on to the heap saying, you know, essentially, let's force Time Warner to divorce itself from these terrible gangster rappers who are corroding the moral fabric of our society.
There's always somebody corroding the moral fabric of our society.
Oh, there's always somebody corroding the moral fabric of our society. It's certainly happening now.
Yeah.
Essentially, though, they forced Morris out, and they fired him, Time Warner did, and they dropped Interscope, which went on to be the most profitable label of the 90s. Morris sort of picked himself up and started this great second act in recording label history, going to Universal and signing all the rappers once again. Throughout the 2000s, his reign was unbelievable. He controlled 33% or more of the U.S. recording market. He signed Kanye West, 50 Cent, Eminem, Rick Ross, Justin Bieber, Taylor Swift. It was just an incredible track record. And he was very well paid for this, but of course he was presiding over an empire in decline that was being, you know, murdered by this new technology, and in particular by a third guy who I write a lot about, who no one's ever heard of before, and his name is Del Glover.
Well, Del Glover is such a great discovery. How did you find this guy?
Well, let's our listeners know who Del Glover is. He was a compact disc manufacturing plant worker who worked for Universal.
And he was at the bottom of the chain.
Very bottom of the chain. It's not like he ever met Morris or anything. You know, he was a factory worker. He was a temp to start with. And he devised with his confederates a method for getting the compact discs out of the plant weeks and sometimes months ahead of their release dates. So all those artists I just named, Kanye West, 50 Cent, Eminem, Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, Glover would get them out through plant security weeks and sometimes months ahead of their release dates and upload them online to this sort of cabal of music leakers that he had joined. From there, they would make their way to the peer-to-peer sites and to torrents and to Napster. And within 48 hours, you could find this music on iPods around the globe. So if any of your listeners have ever had some music on their hard drive, as I did, and they're not exactly sure where it came from, it very likely passed literally through the hands of Del Glover. So how did I find him?
Yeah, how did you find this guy?
Well, the FBI was looking for him for a long time, as were the internal anti-piracy squads of the recording industry. And they had a deuce of a time finding him. It was really tough. They couldn't figure out who it was. But eventually they got somebody in his cabal to flip, and they eventually caught him in 2007. He was arrested, or he was detained in the parking lot of where he worked at the plant on September 13th in 2007, just 1 week after leaking both 50 Cent's Curtis album and Kanye West's Graduation. At the time of his bust, he actually had Graduation in the compact disc player of his car, his leaked copy.
Oops.
They brought it to trial. He pleaded guilty in 2009 to conspiracy to commit copyright infringement. But he agreed to testify against his co-conspirators. And in exchange for this, he got some sentencing leniency, and he was eventually only served 3 months in prison. I found him through this database of government prosecutions by focusing on the pirates. You know, I probably downloaded 100 of these similar cases of people who had been leaking or otherwise involved in this underground scene of media distribution. And when I got to Glover's case file, I was just like, oh, holy crap, like this guy's unbelievable. You know, he leaked so much stuff, and it's just this factory worker. I got to contact him. So I went on Facebook. I sort of looked around for people who fit his demographic profile, the area of the country I knew he lived in, North Carolina, about the right age, let's say 39, 40-ish. And I sent a guy who looked like this guy off Facebook a message saying, hey, I'm a reporter. I'm interested in your story. Thinking, well, if it's not the right guy, there's no harm done. And the next day he called me on his cell phone. And from there, we sort of had a long relationship.
That is so interesting. And you do such a great job of drawing his character. And I love the character arcs in this book, because we have Brandenburg, who starts out as this kind of nerdy, naive engineer, but ends up applying all those engineering smarts to business smarts, which he completely submerges the perception of, so people don't really know that he's just incredibly wealthy.
Yeah.
We have Doug Morris, who's the order taker, and we have Dockery and Del Glover, and you weave these together so well. When you were putting this together, did you create each timeline separately and then weave them back after the fact?
So What you're referring to here is the book has a narrative structure of three sort of interweaving stories of these three different guys, mm-hmm. and they sort of iterate in a almost like a fugue throughout the book, with each chapter returning back after two intermediary chapters. A threaded narrative is a short way of saying that. So for stitching that all together was a little bit tough. I did have to make massive timelines for each person. Some of which, in Morris's case, the timeline went back to 1938, and actually in Brandenburg's case, the timeline went back to 1922, because that's when Eberhard Zwicker, the pioneering father of the discipline that we call psychoacoustics, which is the study of how humans perceive sound, was born. Mm. So they were long, big timelines that sort of were very sprawling. One of the hardest parts of this book was simply organizing all of the information that it contains.
Well, I really love the way that you show Glover, because he's so unprepossessing. Now we have a huge geek culture, Back then we didn't, but he was a geek before there were geeks, and he didn't really advertise it. Talk about how Glover and how did he and his friend Dockery get involved in this shadowy world of kind of the dark net?
I actually don't think of them as geeks. Mm-hmm. Glover really was a rough rider. He was a tough guy. Mm-hmm. He was in kind of like, he has a tattoo of the Grim Reaper on his forearm.
He now thinks
is stupid, but he got him when he was young. He liked at one point he had rims on his car, these floating rims on independent ball bearings, and he loved to go off-roading in his ATV. He was really I described one of his friends on Facebook called him a black redneck, which I think is a really funny but essentially accurate description of him. He's a country guy. He's really friendly, really nice, totally unprepossessing. His interest in computers actually, I think, stems from he's more representative of one of the first wave of the people who, what I would almost call the public internet, people who were joining on AOL and CompuServe in 94 and 95 and just found this technology to be totally fascinating. So he's an early adopter of almost all new forms of technology, but he's not actually a geek. He can't program or anything.
Right.
He's more of a tinkerer type. Uh-huh. He sort of fits a different model. So he really is just an average guy, I think. He's not out there. He's not a representative of geek culture to me. He's a factory worker.
I think he was kind of a front runner of it, because in terms of the ubiquity of it now.
Yes, I would say so.
He got involved in some of these IRC channels. And what are those, and how did he get involved, and how did he meet the shadowy entity known as Kali?
Sure. So listeners of a certain age will remember the Internet Relay Chat channels. That's IRC. If you got on the internet in 94 or 95, the web was actually pretty terrible. It was ugly, and there wasn't a lot to do. You couldn't buy anything. There was no streaming video. Like, it was just a boring place. And the action was actually in these sort of underground chat channels that had been cobbled together piecemeal by average users of the internet. And so you would jump into one, and it was almost like Twitter is now or something. Mm-hmm. It was sort of this free-form, unmoderated discussion of people screaming at each other and doing all sorts of horrible things. But you could also trade files via them. And for Glover, this was critical, because he loved music. He loved getting free music, and he loved getting free crack games like Duke Nukem and Wing Commander from that era. And finally, he figured out that there was a new mode of distribution for music called the MP3. And as early as 96, he was in there, trading Tupac Shakur and other musicians via these MP3 trading chat channels. Eventually, he realized that his privileged position of access in the plant would make him a valuable asset to these guys on the IRC underground who were trading files. And this was actually a subculture that went back even before IRC, called the wares scene from softwares, or more commonly just the scene. Eventually, he was recruited into one of these scene groups as a dedicated leaker, and it was run by a shadowy online entity called Kali, K-A-L-I, the Hindu god of death.
Who proves to be what?
So Kali was running a group called Rabid Neurosis. Uh-huh. And what this group was essentially a dedicated attempt to infiltrate the music industry's supply chain around the world. They had guys in Japan who would get, pre-release albums using offset international release dates. They had guys all over the United States scouring eBay for leaked singles and early promo material. They had
radio stations.
Radio stations. The guys at radio stations, commercial radio stations that were getting advanced copies. They had music journalists in the United Kingdom who were leaking stuff. They had guys in Italy who ran a music promotions business who were leaking stuff. And then finally, best of all, they recruited the real inside men, Tony Dockery and Del Glover, who were friends, who both worked at this compact disc manufacturing plant. And eventually it was Glover who became their key supplier of leaked music in the 2000s. You know, getting that stuff out of the plant, Eminem, 50 Cent, Kanye West, as I said before, and posting it to the internet weeks and sometimes months ahead of the release dates. And this made Rabid Neurosis the leading scene group of all time.
And the bane of Doug Morris.
And the bane of Doug Morris. And the bane of the entire music industry, but especially Doug Morris, who's sort of the character who stands for the music industry in this book. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that was happening, too, that I think is a little bit soft-pedaled in the book is the collusion agreement between all the music manufacturers, the big six, big five, big four, to keep the price of the CD up, to inflate the price of the CD. And I'm wondering how much of the enthusiasm for pirating CDs do you think came from the fact that the public felt that they'd just been taken for the past 10 years? I mean, CDs pretty soon start to seem really expensive for this little piece of plastic that AOL's, when AOL is sending you like three CDs a month and you're paying $14 for 50 cent, you gotta start doing some math there and saying somebody's making a lot of money.
The late 90s were the peak period of profitability in the history of the recording industry. They could sell one of those CDs on average retail for about $14. And it cost them well under $2 and close to a dollar to manufacture it. And a lot of this stuff, remember, a lot of this stuff was stuff they'd sold two or even three times before.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd sold Led Zeppelin on vinyl, 8-track cassette tape, and now they were selling it to you on compact disc, right? So it's actually something you maybe purchased several times in your life, too.
Yeah, this was one that I think that an under-understood aspect of the CD revolution,
right,
was that it just gave people, the companies, a chance to make a huge amount of money on music they'd already made a huge amount of money on.
Yeah, just the back catalog, reselling the back catalog over and over and over again. And then, additionally, and I don't think I soft-pedaled it because I do talk about this, they were also colluding on price with certain retailers like Musicland and Tower Records,
mm-hmm,
essentially offering them pooled resources for advertising funds in exchange for not, you know, discounting the price of compact discs. As I say in the book, this ended up, the Federal Trade Commission, when they eventually went after them for this,
I remember that, yeah,
estimated that this had cost, over a period of about 5 years, about $500 million in excess profits for the recording industry, or about $2 from the pocket of every American. So yeah, they were colluding, and nobody liked the record. Nobody liked the major labels anyway, because, you know, the musicians were constantly complaining about them. It was often these slick corporate guys like Morris, who people are not inclined to like in the first place. You know, as these guys at the Grammys who sort of looked like these bloated corpses in suits. So no one was especially worried about hurting the music industry, and particularly not the corporate music industry. You know, so if they can't make as much money selling NSYNC records, I don't think anyone's, you know, crying a tear over that. Yeah.
I think one of the things too you do is just create these visions of the chances and things lost, because the original impetus for creating the MP3, you point out early in the book, is Brandenburg wants to create a streaming music service. He wants to do Spotify.
Well, this is the most fascinating. This is probably the single most fascinating historical detail that I unearthed in my reporting. In 1982, the same year that the compact disc debuted as a consumer good, this guy, Dieter Seitzer, who was Karlheinz Brandenburg's thesis advisor, applied for a patent on a system whereby over a digital telephone line, you would call into a centralized computer server, you'd dial or touch tone, you'd probably literally rotary dial the song you wanted to hear via your phone, and then you would connect the phone to the stereo and it would come streaming through. And this was the original impetus for the creation of the MP3. The problem was that the phone line could only process about 128,000 bits per second, whereas a compact disc was more like 1.4 million. So they had to shrink the size of the compact disc by more than 90% to get it to fit through this very narrow pipe. Seitzer couldn't figure out how to do it, but he knew Brandenburg was brilliant, like maybe a genius, and so he deputized Brandenburg to come up with this device, this encoder, that would shrink the compact disc so they could stream it through the lines and start their version of, you know, German 1980s Spotify. And Brandenburg did it, actually, which is amazing that he was able to do that. So then they took it to the record companies, and the record companies basically said, yeah, don't let the door hit your butt on the way out, because we're making so much cash off the compact disc, we're not interested in streaming. And it wasn't until they got absolutely murdered, late 2000s, really, that they started to say, okay, yeah, maybe there's something to this model 20 years later.
You talk about a lot of big-selling music. There's a lot of rap acts who walk in and out, and music, rock music, that walks through this book. Do you have a playlist?
There's a playlist of the songs that are mentioned in the book, but it doesn't actually work very well because it's such a kind of it's not a good DJ playlist. You wouldn't want to dance to it because it's such a eclectic collection of music. It doesn't really work. I now have a Spotify playlist that I listen to a lot when I exercise, and most of it is, you know, rap hits from the 2000s. And I actually should say, I really love contemporary music. I really love the contemporary rap and R&B sound, and I think there's a lot of really good music coming out right now. I really like Drake, so I listen to him a lot right now.
Well, that's great to hear. How do we find your the playlist for this book, which I would be interested in hearing just for historical purposes?
I'll tell you what, my Twitter is at Stephen Witt, STEPHENWITT. So I'll put it up there sometime in the next few days.
Oh, that would be great. I'm sure Everybody's going to want to hear it. You know, Morris is such an interesting figure because one of the things you do is to describe how he figured out how to make money with music. And it wasn't through the typical way of falling in love with a band, listening to their demo, going to the session, seeing them live. Now, that's not how Morris discovered music, was it?
No, it was actually the exact opposite. He had been a performing artist when he was very young. He'd actually been signed to Epic Records in the early 60s, and he'd gone nowhere. Later, he'd been a music executive, but his entire career, he'd sort of been a second-tier player until he took over at Atlantic. But he had a philosophy on how you should find, market, and distribute music. And that was sort of to suspend your own taste or just be completely agnostic to the way something sounded like. Instead, he really drove his A&Rs, and these are the guys who go out and recruit and scout bands, to focus on stuff that just seemed like it was trending regionally in a popular way. So the most famous example of this is in 1993 or 94, there was this sort of unexceptionable, super boring bar band in University of South Carolina that was inexplicably selling tons of CDs at local retail stores. Naturally, this attracted the attention of the record labels, so they sent all their A&R scouts down there to the University of South Carolina to listen to the band. Well, the A&Rs come back to the label and they say, look, this band sucks, don't worry about it. Like, it's just a regional blip, it'll never sell. And Morris, who had basically listened to none of this music, was like, no, these guys are the real deal. I can tell because their retail sales from these record stores, they're starting to grow beyond University of South Carolina into other parts of the state and even North Carolina. The name of that band was Hootie and the Blowfish.
Thank you, Doug Morris.
And it's a classic Doug Morris signing. And in one sense, the A&Rs were right. They were an unexceptional, boring bar band, and it's very difficult to understand why they became so popular. But Morris clearly is the right one here. He won. They sold 8 million albums. It was the best-selling album of 1995, Cracked Rear View. And he just understood that it doesn't actually matter what you think. What matters is what moves the retail sales figures, and that's what's gonna move product in the stores. And so this is sort of his philosophy. He, as I say in the book, he doesn't scout the band. He scouts the guy taking the orders from the band because that's who actually knows what's selling.
And what's so fascinating is that while he was making money and bringing in these acts, he made more money than any other person who's his equivalent.
Yeah.
At that same time, the whole music industry was going straight down the toilet.
That's exactly right. Well, he signed the sort of his peak year of power was 1999. That was actually the same year Napster debuted. But it was the most profitable year in the U.S. recording industry's history. And he was running what was by far the largest label. And so this made him the most powerful person maybe in the history of music. arguably, I think so. I say so in the book anyway, so I better stand by that statement. And he was. It was their most profitable time. He was in charge of the biggest label. He was the most powerful guy in music. And he signed this massive contract that paid him out a huge amount of money every year as long as he continued to be profitable, which he was. Now, in the meantime, the you know things like MP3 and Napster and guys like Del Glover who were leaking his music were destroying the industry, sometimes even from the inside for the guy like Del. But Morris sort of saw it coming. He because he spent so much time each morning, woke up each morning, pulled up his computer and looked at the retail sales sheets for the entire U.S., he could see what was selling and he could see what was happening to his industry. So he was able to preserve his job by very aggressively cutting the budgets of the labels that he ran while still managing to take a profit. So he got paid a ton even presiding over an industry that was in free fall.
He decided to follow this idea of prosecuting the bootleggers.
That's right.
When this is such an interesting business model, that the company that sues its own customers.
That's right.
And this is, you do a great job of taking somebody who's been vilified in internet, in the world of the internet, Hillary Rosen, and turning her into a sympathetic character. And I thought, my God, if he can turn Hillary Rosen into a sympathetic character, what else can he do?
The name of this program was internally among the labels was Project Hubcap.
Why Hubcap? Did you ever find that out?
I don't know why. I don't know how they came up with that. And essentially what it was a program of suing the average end-using file sharer. And they filed more than, I think, 17,000 lawsuits of this type over a period of about 4 or 5 years. At one point, they were half the federal, filling up half the docket of the federal courts for all intellectual property cases in the United States.
Oh, my God.
And they were seeking, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 in damages off people, you know, people sharing 12 songs on Kazaa. It was just a completely nonsensical approach. But Morris signed off on it. What was interesting is that the Recording Industry Association of America, which is the music industry's trade and lobbying group, was sort of deputized to actually run this program. And the CEO of the RIAA was a woman named Hillary Rosen, who was not a very popular figure for the reasons you mentioned. But as my reporting revealed, actually she was totally opposed to Project Hubcap. She thought suing the average user was a terrible idea, and it proved it was a terrible idea, and she actually resigned in protest before it happened.
In retrospect, looking back, do you think there was any way that they could have dealt with this bootlegging better?
This is a question I get asked a lot, and I actually don't think so. People love to like light into these recording industry guys for completely failing to miss this new model of distribution. But I've never heard of anybody from the largest corporate label to the smallest indie who actually successfully navigated this. I mean, almost nobody. It was really a difficult time. You had all this digital information being unlocked and distributed for free, and the technology wasn't even there to stop the transfer. Much less the political will to go bust a bunch of bootleggers.
Unfortunately, I remember there's a sentence in your book where you mentioned that Brandenburg offered the music industry a copy protected MP3.
Right.
Oh my God.
And that was 97. Or
yeah.
So. I mean that was pretty early. That was before a couple years before Napster even got off the ground. But they didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just making so much money off the compact disc. And
sure.
This is the thing. Like, as you say, a lot of that money, they weren't really entitled to it. They weren't selling that valuable of a service. You know, they were price gouging, I would argue. They were colluding.
And ripping off their own artists.
Ripping off their own artists. Oh, yeah. And that's the other side of it, which I don't go into that much in the book. But there was also the fact that, you know, your royalty rates on a compact disc for the first-time artist might be as low as, like, 8%. Of MSRP. So it just wasn't a great deal either way. And they sat in the middle collecting these huge rents.
I love how you note that on their back catalog, Doug Morgan's inherited MCA, which was called Music Cemetery of America.
Well, he actually ran MCA for a brief period. The MCA was essentially assembled into this Vivendi Universal conglomerate, which I go a bit into in the book. But it ended up being after he got fired from Time Warner, that was where he landed at the Music Cemetery of America.
And there's some really interesting side characters. I love Junior.
Junior. Junior, who is Edgar Bronfman Jr., who actually ran Warner Music Group later. He was the scion of a very wealthy French-Canadian family who ran the Seagram Liquor Empire, which included, you know, Seagrams, but at one point they also owned Tropicana Orange Juice and a huge stake in the chemical company DuPont. And Junior sold all that to become an entertainment conglomerate in kind of a demented bid for, you know, celebrity.
You write, so it's so entertaining the way you write it, because you describe that the orange juice industry was stable, boring, and profitable.
Yeah.
The music industry was exciting, weird, and rife with pitfalls to lose money. Exactly what
that's
he liked.
That's right. Well, as you know, the number of orange juice cartons I sell this year is a pretty good guide to the number of orange juice cartons I'm going to sell next year.
Oh, absolutely.
But the number of Meghan Trainor CDs I sell this year isn't a terrible guide to the number of Meghan Trainor CDs I'm going to sell next year. The music industry essentially has to reinvent its product line from scratch every year. That's what it means to be in the entertainment business. Mm.
You also, one of the most wonderful side characters you unearth is the man behind Oink. So tell us, who is the man behind Oink, and how did he get that name? And he's where you got a lot of your music from, isn't it?
That's right. He was actually, his name was Alan Ellis. He was a university student. He was a university student at University of Teesside in Middlesbrough, United Kingdom. He was studying computer science, but he wasn't really satisfied with his education. So he decided to start this torrent site as like a side project. He was never really supposed to go anywhere, but he began to get these people who were obsessed with encoding and uploading high-fidelity music and building these massive archives of distributed, crowdsourced information. So it ended up being like a sort of an illegal version of something like Wikipedia, you know, where you had people working without any obvious benefit to themselves for hundreds and sometimes thousands of hours a year to post these enormous archives of digitized music online. At its peak, it was four times the size of iTunes. It was an invitation-only torrent site, so the only way to get in, and the name of it was Oink's Pink Palace, as you said, and the only way to get in was to sort of either pass an entrance interview or have somebody vouch for you.
How did you get in?
I had somebody vouch for me. I'm not going to say who.
Now, we're in a post-MP3, post-CD world right now.
That's right.
Where do you think this is all going? Do you think – I see all these Spotify and Tidal. There's a lot of these services starting up. And I just wonder, you know, if they're the next Zune.
No, I don't think so. Spotify is very popular,
mm-hmm.
Particularly among people under the age of 25.
Is it popular with the artists whose music is being played?
Some, but not all. Some are right now, the payout rates on royalties are about 0.7 cents per share, per stream. Sorry, and that is not a very good payout. So you have a lot of people complaining about these very low payout rates they're getting from Spotify. Worse than that, actually, is YouTube, which pays about 0.01 cents per share. Or 0.1 cents per share, or 0.001 cents of a dollar, meaning you have to listen to get about 1,000 plays to earn $1 off YouTube, which isn't a lot. So the streaming wars right now are pulling in lots of customers, which is good. And if you subscribe to one, as I do, I subscribe to Spotify, and I think it's a great service. But they're doing that. The streaming companies themselves are losing money,
mm-hmm.
and the artists aren't making very much. So that's not a sustainable formula.
One of the things you say is that to remember that a format war is indeed a war, and there will be victors, and there will be villains, and there will be victims.
And there will be tactics, and there will be underhanded plays because it's a war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we're currently having. It's not so much a format war now as it is sort of a sort of classic business war for market share among very many competing firms. You know, in addition to Spotify, there's Apple Music, which was announced very recently. There's Tidal. There's Google will introduce its service called YouTube's Music Key later this year. And that's in addition to another service they already have.
Play, right?
Yeah, Google Play.
Mm-hmm.
Those will probably be, I assume they'll be wrapped into one service. There's Deezer, Slacker, Pandora. There's a ton of stuff. So this appears to be that the model that that the music industry and the technologists have decided to go into. And there's a lot of enthusiasm from the consumer for it, especially among younger people, and especially among people who listen to a lot of music, like I do. Mm-hmm. You know, for a long time, I was a serial pirate. I was the music industry's worst customer, you know, because not only did I not pay for anything, I actually shared it with other people. So I was corroding their entire thing. Now I'm an evangelist for Spotify. Now I'm an evangelist for Spotify. And this isn't because I've had some sort of moral awakening, or maybe I should have, but I didn't. It's just because Spotify practically is way more convenient than pirating, I think they finally solved it.
Where do you think you'll be aiming your journalistic eyes next?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have another big project. It took me 5 years to write this book. I started in 2010, which was sort of the peak year of iPod sales. Mm-hmm. And now the iPod is obsolete, so I had to...
Is it really? God, I still have my original
iPod. They're not selling any of them anymore. Everyone's moved to the streaming services in the iPhone.
Really?
Yeah, for sure.
And that's so interesting. I myself am I still buy CDs, and I also download stuff from iTunes, and I'll download stuff from iTunes and buy the CD just because I have a high distrust of my iTunes library continuing to work.
Well, not only that, but if you're subscribing to Spotify, it could all just go away someday, right? Like, it'll just disappear. Like the artists can easily just pull their music off the service and then you can't access it anymore. We'll see if that continues. The problem is if they do that, then you can always just return to piracy. For me, I think the next thing I want to write about, you know, this started out as a book about a very sort of like narrow piece of technology, but it ended up being a book about the way that technology and the social order intertwine and influence one another.
Exactly. I think that's what's so great to read. It's really fascinating to see that. And also, too, the relationship between business and art.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I think I want to find something that's similar to that. I'm thinking, actually, I have an idea about writing a book about sort of medicine and how medicine enables, in some ways, contemporary sexual mores and cultural mores. You know, if you look at the world we live in, it's sort of, we live in a very promiscuous world, which I think is I like that. It's nice. But we couldn't imagine trying to live in that world without antibiotics, birth control, you know, Plan B, DNA testing, and all of the other things that sort of affect the way that we think about our own ability to procreate and reproductive health. You know, you couldn't live this way in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Technology underpins it. And so I think looking into the future of stuff like that, there's stuff like in vitro fertilization, there's something called CRISPR, which will allow genetic editing of blastocysts and embryos. And those technologies, too, will completely reshape, I think, both sexual, reproductive, family life, and the way that we think about our society. So I think that's the next target.
I'm looking forward to it. I think, too, that it was so interesting the way how much things changed when they began allowing manufacturers to advertise drugs.
Yes, that is also very interesting, which they never should have done.
They never should have done.
Right.
I always like hearing these advertisements for drugs where the side effects seem worse than whatever it is they're trying to cure.
Well, and sometimes the diseases were almost entirely fictional. So if you look at ADHD or something, it's not even clear. It's not like diabetes. It's not like you can take a blood test and be like, oh, you have ADHD, right?
No.
It's essentially like someone just decides that you have it based on like a very rough set of diagnostic criteria, and the inventor of ADHD, or the guy who first diagnosed the disease, felt that it was being massively overdiagnosed in this country. And what were they prescribing? Well, it's called Adderall, but if you look at the chemical ingredients, it's an amphetamine, and they're
speed.
Giving this,
yay.
And they're giving it to 4-year-olds. So I agree. My drugs are very much overmarketed in this country.
4-year-olds on speed. There's your next book.
I feel like this book has been written already. That's how I know about it.
I've been speaking with Stephen Witt. His new book is How Music Got Free. Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.